So there's this idea, it's called the uncanny valley, right? And so the uncanny valley is when the AI is too lifelike, it confuses the customer. It is better to actually be intentional and make it so that it is apparent that it's an AI, because then the customer doesn't try and do things that a human would do, right?
Welcome to the Sensei Playbook, the ultimate podcast for the automotive industry. Each week, we dive into the success stories and best practices from industry leaders with customer experience first. From driving repeat business to earning coveted referrals, discover the tools and tactics that set the best apart. Get ready to hit the road to success. This is the Sensei Playbook.
I want to introduce a very special guest today to the Sensei Playbook. This guy is a super achiever that crushes everything he takes on. He is one of the most effective communicators I've ever met. Accomplished Brazilian black belt jiu-jitsu. Derek, great to see you again, buddy. We met 20 years ago now.
It's been at least 20 years.
I think
it was 2002. Yeah.
Okay. 2002. So, wow. That's at the Cardone Group, Orlando, yeah. Florida.
Yeah.
So, what's been going on? Tell us what's going on in your world today.
So it's wild, man. I worked with Grant and Scott for 17, 18 years at the Cardone Group, and it exposed me to so much, whether it was the consulting aspect or the software or software as a service sales, or, you know, actually working with the OEM, working with all the different departments as far as consulting, parts, wholesale, service, all that stuff. I felt like it was just an incredible time to experience all the things that were going on in automotive. And then after that, I got recruited to go back into retail, and I did. I was in retail for about 5 years, ended up being the COO of Ziegler Automotive up in the Midwest. You know, we had, at the time, 35, 36 dealerships across Michigan, Indiana, and Illinois, and that was an amazing opportunity, 100 employees, just a ridiculously large group, and I got to really learn even a lot more about dealership and dealership operations, and just had an incredible time working with that group and learned a lot. And then I got approached by a company out of Silicon Valley that was doing AI, and specifically an AI communications platform. And when I saw it, I went, that is the future, my friend. That is what I need to learn about. And so I came to work with them as the executive vice president, and man, it has just been a rocket ship ever since. And that will be, August will be 3 years for me. So I started with them August of 3 years ago. So it was coming out of COVID. The world was still a little bit weird, you know, in 2021. And just, it's been really interesting to be around AI for the last 3 years and to see the evolution of what's happening with artificial intelligence. I mean, like, it, you know, this is wild. Our company has been in existence for over 7 years. October will be 8 years officially for the company. They were not focused on automotive at all pre-me. They were working with small, medium-sized businesses all across the United States, and literally thousands of businesses. So dog groomers, we still have a hospital, we still have a credit union, we still have insurance companies, we have doctors, lawyers, dentists, restaurants, a ton of restaurants use us. So all these people were using AI because they couldn't keep up with the call volume as a small, medium-sized business. Well, we got found by a Toyota dealer up in Northern California, and the guy's like, I think this is a solution I need for my service drive. You know, our CEO, our COO, and our head of technology, the three co-founders, they don't know anything about automotive. So they went out and did a time and motion study at this dealership because they literally thought that a service advisor sat at a desk and all they did was just type up repair orders all day long. They didn't know that service advisors are the busiest people in the dealership, that they're clocking 20,000 steps a day, that the phone never stops ringing. There's either a tech or a warranty clerk or a customer standing in front of them all day long, right? That they're literally the most engaged and busiest people in the dealership. They had no idea. And so it ended up being what they call an incredible product market fit. And they also realized they didn't have any automotive DNA. That's when they came out and said, hey, why don't you come work with us? So I did. I joined the company. At the time, I think we had like 5 paying automotive clients. And today, we are north of 600 paying automotive clients. And we have won a ridiculous amount of awards over the last 3 years for our technology. We got named the AI Tech Titan of the Year earlier this year out in Silicon Valley, and that's a Silicon Valley award, not an automotive one, which was pretty badass. In October of last year, Inc. reached out to us and said, hey, we wanted to let you know that you guys debuted on the Inc. 5000 list at 809. We weren't even on it the year before, and we debuted at 809, and the growth has just been, you know, exponential. It's a typical hockey stick kind of acceleration, right? And so we're excited about what this means and the direction that we're going, and our executive team is extraordinary because they are Silicon Valley tech geniuses. They're not car guys, and I'm not knocking car guys, but they're not car guys that said, hey, I got a solution. I got a problem. I've developed a solution, and now I want to go sell it to other car guys. Literally, they built an industry-defining communication platform powered by AI that can be used by hundreds of thousands of businesses worldwide. And it just so happens to solve a major issue that we have in automotive, which is communication, right? And so that has been a game changer for us because it is built with true Silicon Valley backbone. It's not something that was just kind of, you know, piece and parted together. Like, literally, I cannot tell you how many times I get comments from people that are saying, this is incredible. This stuff just works. I'm like, well, yeah. Like, it's, somebody told me, he goes, every time I get, this is a service director, every time I get a new piece of software, I immediately try and break it. He goes, I haven't broke yours yet. He goes, I really think of it like it's an Apple product. And I'm like, well, some of our key designers came from Apple, so that would be why he got that feeling. That's a short version of the last 22 years.
I want to dive deeper into Numa, but before we go there, you went from retail, because you were in retail, then you worked for Cardone for 17 years, then you went back to retail. Yeah. What was that like?
Crazy. Crazy. I love the automobile business, and I sold my first car in 1989. I sold a Dodge Omni in 1989. I mean, this is my 25th year. December will be my 35th year in automotive. I'll never get away from it. I absolutely love it. And the thing I love the most about what we do in automotive is that every day it's a drive to succeed, right? And I still tell people, automotive is the last bastion of free enterprise in America. Like, if you want to get up in the morning and go to work with an uncapped earning potential, you can go do it as a salesperson. That's like right now. There's nobody holding you back.
Right.
You have the ability to build out your own business inside of a multi-billion dollar business, inside of a multi-trillion dollar industry, right? And there's nobody holding you back. And I just look at that, and that just gets me excited every single day for what we do, because we are helping people manage their own businesses inside of these businesses, right? You're doing the same thing. You're doing the same thing with reputation management, right? You're helping individuals inside of dealerships manage their own business and to get more success and to be more successful. And so we're doing the same thing with individuals on this side. And we literally just signed up a 4-store dealer group, and the guy sent me a message and said, you probably don't remember this. You hired me 30 years ago, and I've worked my way up, and now I'm X position at this dealer group, and thank you for giving me that shot. And to have stuff like that happen. And I run into people all the time from Cardone, and they're like, you have no idea how much you helped me with my career and how much your coaching helped. And then I talk to people that I've worked with at Ziegler or with Friendship, and, you know, to have them go on and to do great things, it's really cool to see that. And that's the reason why I love this industry. Like, I cannot imagine being around anything other than automotive. Like, I just can't.
I've sold many different industries. And in fact, with Reputation Sensei, we went into home services, healthcare, some franchise models. And I always tell people that I really didn't appreciate the automotive industry until I tried to sell those other industries. Automotive is fun because they appreciate good salesmanship. Second, fast decisions. They don't take forever. I call them the gunslingers. If they like it, they're like, sure, send over an agreement. Let's do it. So, yeah, I love the automotive industry.
It's fun. Now, before we get into more conversation, I have to tell a funny story about Chris.
Yeah, please do. I am always open to embarrassing, funny stories about Chris. So.
Yeah, I don't know that it's embarrassing to him. I think it's not embarrassing to me because he got me good. But
Okay, good.
So I flew through Atlanta in, you know, I don't know, mid-2000s, right? And I called Chris. I'm like, hey, dude, I'm going to do a layover here because I can't catch the flight to where I got to go. He's like, great, come to the house. We'll go get a workout. We'll go get dinner. And I'm like, perfect. I don't have any clothes. He goes, no, don't worry about it. I got clothes for it. So we go, we work out. We get a great workout. We just crush it. Chris is just, you know, he's just jacked, right? And he's over there. I can't move my arms after we get done working out. I go home. I shower, and I'm like, hey, dude, you got some clothes for me? He goes, yeah. He goes, I got this new tracksuit. I haven't even worn it. And he brings me a tracksuit. It's a white Adidas tracksuit. It's white top, white bottom, black stripe. Okay? I'm like, damn, I look like a Russian mafia guy, right? I'm like, okay, Chris, I see what we're doing, right? So I put it on. I don't got any other clothes. So I got this on. By the way, I think I'm wearing my dress shoes with it, but that's another story. So I walk out. He walks out. He's wearing a black Adidas tracksuit with white stripes. We literally have on the exact same but inverted.
Like inverted outfit.
Yeah. Yeah. So we go to dinner. We go to dinner in this little borough of Atlanta, Hotlanta, where Chris lived at the time, that at the point was the number one alternative neighborhood in Atlanta. So many people came up and said, you guys are the cutest couple ever. They just were like all up. We couldn't eat. They were just at the table. They're like, oh my God, you guys are so cute. And I was like, I just kept looking at him. I'm like,
oh my God.
Do you remember this, Chris?
I don't even remember it.
You blocked it out or anything?
We walked and then we went to some restaurant. It was all dudes. Like everybody in the restaurant was a dude, and they loved us. They were like, "You're the cutest couple ever."
Do you not have a photo of this? Is this like?
I definitely did. I wish I had that tracksuit. I'd wear it unzipped with a gold chain. Now that I got the gray beard, right? I can pull it off.
That's a nice big medallion.
Oh my God! Are you sure?
I was like, he got back to the house, and I was like, he goes, I swear to God, I didn't plan that.
I had to be downtown when that happened. It couldn't have been in Peachtree Quarters.
We were downtown. I thought downtown was Peachtree.
Okay.
It was downtown. It was the house that you had that was right on the street, and we walked out with.
Okay, now I'm remembering.
True story, Jeff. So if he ever says he's got clothes for you to wear for some reason, check what he's going to wear after.
His arms would be like this on my arms.
They're stretched out.
They're all stretched out. It would be like wearing a muumuu or something for me.
I remember another time you had just competed in a BJJ match, and you were, I think, had a torn shoulder, and you came to my house. Yeah, you're in bad shape, and you still went and trained. I mean, you were like, nope, I got to train. I was like, I do want to talk about that because I was telling Jesse that you had a really fast track to your black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. How many years did it take you?
Nine.
So that's still a fast track. Yeah, it typically takes 10 or 11, I think.
How'd you fall into it?
What's that?
How'd you fall into BJJ?
So I'm a lifelong martial arts guy, right? Okay. And so I did karate and I did 10 years of Aikido, and I was doing triathlons and I was competing in Olympic distance triathlons. And what I found was that I was training like 20 to 24 hours a week. And at the time, my kids were pretty young and I just didn't want to be away from the kids that long. And I love to train, right? So there's working out and there's training, right?
Yeah.
So I work out so that my training and my competing is better. That's, you know, I like to work out as well, but I think of training differently. And so I was training for these Olympic distance triathlons and it was just taking so much time. I was like, man, I can't do this to the family. It's not fair. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I looked and I was like, well, I'm going to try this Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I had watched the first UFC, right. And I saw Royce Gracie and I saw him beat everybody. And the guy's built like me. You know, he's 6'3" and he's 189 pounds. And I'm like, I'm 6'2", 189. I got these long arms. I'm like, let's do this thing. And so I went to Gracie Baja, Orlando, Professor Marcio Simas, who, by the way, is Carlos Gracie Jr.'s oldest, longest black belt. I trained under Professor Marcio and Professor Gucci for, you know, well, going on 20-something years now, but at the time, 8, 9, 10 years as I worked my way up to get my black belt, literally trained under guys that were at the original Gracie Baja in Brazil. And it was just incredible to get that kind of training. And then I've trained with Royce since then and a bunch of the other Gracies and Ryan and Henner and, you know, just all kinds of great people all across the United States. And this is while I was at Cardone. And so I was traveling. And so Chris made this mention, but that was, I think, what really helped escalate my jiu-jitsu to a different level was that I wasn't exposed to just my school and then going and competing against other people. I literally trained half of my time at other gyms.
Yeah.
I got to go and train with other styles and other people and other focuses, and it just really broadened my horizon and gave me a lot more experience, I think, than, you know, what you would traditionally get if you just went to your one gym and trained 3 days a week. Kind of cool.
And you were awarded your black belt after you won Worlds, right? And
so I got my black belt after I took second in the open class at Abu Dhabi. So in Abu Dhabi, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is like the national sport. So I qualified for Abu Dhabi. I flew to Abu Dhabi and I competed in the 35 and up class. And I think I was 43 or 44 at the time. And literally, I'm in the warm-up room training, getting ready to go out and fight. And it's the who's who of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu that's in there training. Like it would be equivalent to a casual football player that's older that is warming up in the same room that the people are warming up for the Hall of Fame game, right? Or for the All-Star Weekend game. It was literally, that's what it was like for me. Like every person I look at, I'm like, oh my God, I know that guy, I know that guy, I know that girl, I know that girl. They're all the who's who of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at the time. So it was wild. And so I went there. I ended up taking second. I lost to a Venezuelan guy that was incredible. It was just it was a great experience. I say it's my Olympics. I got my medal, was awarded to me by the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. Put the medal on me. And it's one of my favorite photos. I'm standing on the podium, right? They got the American flag. They got me up there. He puts the medal on me, and it was like, yeah, that's my Olympics. Right? That's my thing. Now, I had won a couple world championships. I've won multiple Pan Ams. I've traveled all over the United States and Canada and the world, I guess, if you consider Abu Dhabi. But I just love Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And again, it goes back to kind of the same thing with Otto. It's the camaraderie, right? There is that camaraderie that you get when you train with somebody. It's the same as you get when you work with somebody intensely and closely, and you build that trust and that relationship. And so I think that's a lot of the reason why the car business resonates with me so much, is because you get that feeling of being a part of something. And that's pretty freaking cool, right? Really cool.
And when you came back, they awarded you, right, after that event. Yeah. They awarded you your black.
Yeah, so Professor Gucci was with me in Abu Dhabi, and he wanted to give me my black belt on the podium. But Professor Marcio said, absolutely not. He's trained here for 10 years almost. I want to be the one to be there with you when you put the belt on him. And like, it was just, they actually got into a fight about it. And they told me afterwards that they were arguing because Gucci's like, he'll remember it forever. And Marcy's like, no, I want the school to celebrate with him. I want him to get it here. So they gave me an out of cycle promotion and they called everybody in, and like, it was amazing. And at the time, I think that there was probably around 1,000 Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts in the world that were registered with the IBJJF. And so that was a pretty exclusive club to get pulled into. And I competed from the time I was a blue belt. I started competing when I was a blue belt. And I competed every belt and competed at the highest level I possibly could at every belt. Blue belt, purple belt, brown belt, and black belt. I've competed a ton. And Marcio one time told the group when I got promoted, he said, see him? He fought his way up. He earned this belt because he competed. And he was trying to motivate the other individuals in the school to compete, because if you prepare for a competition, it doesn't matter if you win or you lose, you get so much out of the preparation for that competition, right? Because you learn more about yourself when you set that target and you have a goal and you work towards that goal and you push yourself. And that's what happens, right? If you just go to class and you show up and you do, you know, you roll around, blah, 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 play a little pajama wrestling, and then get up and go home, it's not the same as working towards a goal. And so that was what he was trying to say. It's like, hey, set a goal, go out there, use that goal to push yourself, and move forward.
What is it that drives your competitiveness?
I've got two absolutely insanely amazing children, and I want them to know that they can do whatever the hell they want to do. And I want to be there for their kids and their kids' kids, and I will do whatever it takes to maintain that. Getting too emotional, there you go. There's my answer.
That's good. Having kids definitely changes your perspective on things, for sure.
Do you remember when, I first came down to Orlando, was it 2002? And we went to your house, and you were throwing yourself, how old was he then? Oh, my gosh.
He was 2 years old. He was 2 years old.
And you were throwing him a football, a little football, across the room, and he was catching that. I couldn't believe it. I mean, he was so athletic at 2 years old. I mean, you were jumping the thing all the way across the room, and he was jumping up in the air and catching it. I'll never forget that.
He went on, when he was 15, he won the USA Gymnastics Junior Olympics men's for the Southeast region. He was the number one finisher all around. That was, we knew he had worked towards that, and we knew at that point in time that was his last gymnastics run because he's going to be too big. He's 6 foot tall, he's 190 pounds. That's not a gymnast, right? And so he was growing, and he was rapidly growing out of the size to be a gymnast. But, I mean, just absolutely incredible. And then he switched over and became a punter in high school, and he was a pole vaulter in high school. Was great at both of those. He's graduating college in May and moving on to do his veterinary medicine degree. And my daughter is graduating in December. She was also a pole vaulter. She was the captain of the track team. She ran the hurdles and pole vaulted. She was captain of the cheerleading squad. They both have just been really, they've gone out, same thing. If they see a goal, they set it and they do it. And they believe in it because they saw me do it, right? And so I always talk to them about goal setting and about, hey, look, if you want something, this goes back to Grant, right? Grant always says that it's that 10X rule. It takes 10 times the effort that you think it takes to achieve the result that you want. And so if you're willing to commit to something, you have to be willing to commit to doing 10 times what you think that it's going to take to get there. And to have that discussion with your kids when they're 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and then they see you live that, and then they live it themselves, it's crazy.
Yep.
Right? It's crazy to see that kind of stuff.
That's awesome. Well, you're not only an inspiration to them, but they're an inspiration to you, it sounds like it.
Yeah, for sure.
Very cool. Yeah, I've done some marathons in my day, and the training is just so time-consuming. It's not practical to have a family and to run marathons because you spend every Saturday and Sunday 6 hours away from the house just running through the woods. That's just hours and hours and hours of training. So, yeah, maybe I should take up BJJ instead.
So, funny story, Jesse. One of my coaches said, you know, you ought to try an ultra marathon. I've never ran a marathon. I've never ran a half marathon in a race. I'd done it in triathlons, but I'd never ran a specific half marathon or a marathon. He said, you ought to try an ultra marathon. And so I did 16 weeks of prep and ran my first 50K. And I ran an ultra trail, and then I ran a 50-miler, and then I ran, like, three more 50Ks. And I haven't raced since then. That was 2018. And my girlfriend and I are currently, like, 7 or 8 weeks in the couch to half marathon because she's never been a runner. She was a competitive surfer, and she's in just ridiculous shape, but she never ran. And I didn't want her to get hurt, so I was like, hey, look, we'll do this walk-run thing because I have a friend that's running the 100-mile ultra in November, and we're pace running it. Right. And so the whole goal is that we're going to get him through the night because that's the hardest part. So I'm going to pace run him. Me and another friend and her now are going to pace run him. But as we were doing this, all of a sudden we ran some 5Ks and now we ran some 10Ks and now we're doing a 6 mile training run, you know, on Saturdays, like what you're talking about. But it's just been this fun thing for us because we're running together. You know, we're talking the whole time that we're running. And I'm not leaving the kids, right? Because it's just her and I. You know, the kids are both away at college, so it's just amazing. So it's a different deal now. So it's kind of, I bet you might lace up those shoes again. That's all I'm saying.
I still run, but I just do like 6 miles, 8 miles. It's a different beast to try to, the training for a marathon, if you're actually trying to run it and competing in it, it's just you're up at 4 a.m, 5 days a week, trying to get it for work. Cool. So you are now firmly in the SaaS world, huh? What are the main differences there between, I guess, even the economics or the just being in that industry and sort of straddling that and automotive?
In automotive, I've always felt pretty confident about my knowledge base, right? Might not be the smartest guy in the room, but I definitely understand everything that's happening, right? You know what I mean? I've just got that experience. I've been around. And I started working with these guys and out of Silicon Valley and I realized, not only am I not the smartest guy in the room, I don't have a clue what the hell's going on at the time, right? So I got invited to the sales leaders kind of summit that is all of the sales leaders for one of the venture capital firms that had invested in us as an early stage company. And so there's like 80 different sales leaders in this. And so we do every 3 weeks we do a Zoom meeting and we all get on and talk about different topics and stuff. And the first meeting I went to with our COO, and you know, we've got Slack open on the side because they all use Slack. And so I'm Slacking and doing the thing. And I'm like, I feel like I am playing buzzword bingo or abbreviation bingo, because they're like TMA and CDP and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I have no idea what the hell they're even talking about. Like, I get the concept, but like, I don't know what's happening here. And I'm like, if I took a drink every time somebody used an acronym, I'd be hammered at this moment in time. And so it's been wild getting exposed to the other side of the industry, because in automotive software, typically you work with a lot of people that came out of the car business. And so you have a shared language of the way that we talk about the world in auto that we all use. Well, they have a shared language that is SaaS. And so when they're saying TAM, and I'm like, who's TAM? Is that TAM? And it's the total addressable market. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, okay. So you're saying how many potential clients we have, right? No, I think
ICP. Yeah. How big is our market? ICP.
Oh, the ideal customer profile. Got it. You start learning these things and you're like, okay, all that stuff makes sense and I get it. And, you know, we would just say it a little bit different than automotive, but now having straddled the fence on both sides of it, it's wild. And I am so thankful every single day, because our CEO, his last company, he started in early 2000, very first company to use GPS on mobile phones. They are actually the very first use case in the geofence patent, because in their app, you drew a fence around where your kid's phone could be or where the kid could be. And if the phone went outside of that fence, it alerted the parents. So they were the number one family safety app on any of the cellular network's products before the iPhone even came out. And so he sold that company in 2015 with over 100 million users worldwide. And so, like, what he sees in his vision is so different than what I'm used to, right? Because, look, when you come out of automotive, what do? We do a financial statement every month in the car business. And so what does that mean? It means that we've got a very short sales cycle, very short mentality. It is literally what happens in this 30 days, because that's what comes on my paycheck. Right? That's just reality. And so when you look at somebody that actually has a vision that's 3 to 5 years in the future, and you're consistently marching towards that vision, that's different. That's different, right? And so I'm learning from these guys, and it's just every single day I feel like my brain gets stretched. Some days it's good. And, you know, we all know about imposter syndrome. There's multiple days where I would be out there going, I got imposter syndrome. This is maybe I'm not the right guy for this. I remember our CEO sent me a deck when I was flying out to San Francisco, and I was presenting this deck to the executive team, the other C-suite, and ultimately this was going to the board. And in it, you know, he's got the projections over the next 5 years. And I'm like, I can get us to 10 million. I can get us to 20 million. Maybe I can get us to 30 million. Well, then there's 40 and 50 and there's 100 and there's 200 million in sales. And I'm like, what the hell are we going to do? How am I going to do this? And I start freaking out. I'm looking at the lifetime value of a customer thinking, oh, how many customers do we got to acquire? Where are we going to get all these customers? How do we get to this dollar? I didn't think that night. And I show up the next day and he's like, you tired? I'm like, dude, you sent me that deck and it broke me. Like, I was up all night long trying to do the math. And he's like, oh, man, don't worry about that. That's how we have to think, though, is that we have to have this stuff in front of us, because if we are not shooting for that target, we're never going to hit it, right? We're never going to come close. And so it's crazy.
So what do you do to address the imposter syndrome?
Work my ass off. And I know that sounds dumb, but I've really tried to learn the industry in the way that the rest of Silicon Valley looks at SaaS, right? We've been lucky that we've been able to hire a consultant that's helped us out with some of our sales process stuff, because we need to be more closely aligned with the way that other SaaS companies do. Because if you're not, then the investors look at you and they're like, well, what are you guys doing? This doesn't even make sense. When you run it, and I came in and I started running it the way that we did software sales at Cardone, right? Which, Chris, you know, we grew really rapidly. But the problem is that doesn't scale. And so when you start thinking about things in terms of scale, what you do to get from 1 million in sales to 2 million in sales, and what you get from 2 to 4 and 4 to 8 and 8 to 16, they're not the same, right? Each time is an evolution, and you have to figure out what are those evolutions that you have to do. What we're doing today in sales is a complete evolution of where we were a year ago, right? And we're still killing it. We're still growing rapidly. And I know that what we do today in sales will be changed within the next 12 months because we have to keep growing, right? We're going to have 18 salespeople here shortly. We'll have 36, 37 salespeople by July of next year, right? That's the kind of growth that we're seeing. And you can't have a sales process at that level that's just loosey-goosey, right? Because you have to have the people doing the things. You have to have a data-driven company. You have to be looking at the different elements, right? You can't just hope that the guy's going to show up and do the right job. And so we're really, every day we evolve and every day we grow and every day we document, every day we start paying new data points, and every day we start looking at this from the standpoint of what do we got to do to be successful. Right.
What's the biggest wow factor? Like, when you tell someone about Pneuma, what's the one thing that just wows the dealer? Like, wow, how does it happen?
There's two things that I think that are the biggest wow factor. We've answered north of 20 million phone calls for dealerships in the last 2.5 years. Okay. Our average for a call that rings to a service advisor where a customer leaves a voicemail, our average response time right now is 13 minutes and 30 seconds. And I say to dealers all the time, what would happen if your service advisors called 100% of your customers back in 15 minutes or less? What would happen? And they're like, a lot of good stuff. I'm like, yeah, TSI goes up, so does dollars per RO. We've proven it. It's that simple. And so the magic for us is driving that accountability that's never been there in that communication and holding the people accountable, right, through escalation, in getting to these numbers. And that's the wow factor. Like, dealers, the rest of it's just gravy. Because I cannot tell you how many dealers tell me, when I go home at night and I walk by the service drive, every one of the service advisors' phones got a blinking red light on it for a voicemail that didn't get returned today.
Sure.
Right? And think about that. That's a customer that called in today that's not going to get a response until tomorrow. And every one of their lights is blinking. That's a negative, no matter how you slice it. And so when a customer calls the dealership, we have to be responsive. If they call to schedule an appointment, and this is what drives me bonkers, we live in a microwave popcorn generation. It's just reality. If you call a business and they don't respond in 15 minutes, what are you doing? Cool. It doesn't matter what business it is.
Yeah.
What are you doing? You're looking for somebody else.
Yeah.
If I call you for a brake job and you don't call me back, I'm turning left into Pep Boys when I'm driving down the road going, hey, man, can you put brakes on my car? And the minute we lose them to Pep Boys, they don't come back. We lose all that maintenance. They go to Pep Boys from then on because they see how easy it was and how much cheaper it was, right? And so that is a real, true issue in dealerships. And when dealerships acknowledge this and say, you're right, we need to do a better job with communication, those dealerships, those are the ones that are growing and growing and growing. That's just incredible.
How do you leverage your own sales technology to – like your CRM, other, you know, data providers you might have to make the most of your time and make your process efficient when you're out trying to find new clients?
Obviously, we work with a bunch of different data providers, right? So ZoomInfo is one. And we find that the single best way that we grow is through word of mouth. And so dealers talk. There is a joke that the three fastest forms of communication are telephone, telegraph, and telecar dealer, right? And when you tell a car dealer something, they're going to tell everybody they know. And that's what we see when we go into a market and we hit that market and things go good with Pneuma, they tell their friends. So then we start prospecting in the surrounding areas of the dealership, and we use ZoomInfo to build out lists and create, oh, and Chris is gone. And we build out those lists, and then we work from there.
So you go you zero in on geography and try to take over that market.
And it's wild because if you look, the three biggest states for us really are Washington State, California, and Texas. And that's because we've had so many successful dealers in those markets.
Okay. And do you find that, well, I guess we found the same thing, that the cold Zoom leads converted a much, much lower. It's almost not worth your time. And a lot of these data enrichment, that still is, I think there's still a lot to be desired with a lot of the data enrichment out there too. So
yeah, it's not, all it is a tool, right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's a face-to-face business, and we just want to provide our sellers, our regional sales managers, the opportunity to be able to pull up a list, look at who's in the market space, go out and start working with those dealers, and, you know, reference some of the successes that we're having in the market. And that's where we get the growth. That's where it comes from.
Derek, where is it going to be in 5 or 10 years? We've all heard the Apple AI spokesperson talking to the customer. And
yeah,
even though it was close, you could still tell it was AI. How soon will we see people talking to AI and not know that it's AI?
We could do it today. Yeah.
Is it happening?
No, we don't do it intentionally. So there's this idea, it's called the uncanny valley, right? And so the uncanny valley is when the AI is too lifelike, it confuses the customer. It is better to actually be intentional and make it so that it is apparent that it's an AI, because then the customer doesn't try and do things that a human would do, right? And that's where AI gets into problems today, because it still has issues interpreting a lot of the subtleties. And so we stay out of that by making it very apparent that we are an AI assistant, and by keeping the conversation locked into idea of 90% of whatever the question is that we're trying to resolve. I know that's kind of...
Give us an example.
On an appointment. So, here, let's just back up a step. Do you guys remember that article that came out where a guy convinced the AI chatbot to sell him the car for a dollar?
Yes.
So, that AI got outside of what we consider the 90% lane. And so, here's how it works. If our AI is talking with a customer, and the customer says, I want to schedule an appointment, and we say, okay, we have a 9:30 available, and then the customer says, how long will it take me to get there from my house? Right? At that point in time, the AI is going to be like, we're starting to get outside the scope of where we're going. So the AI might say, I can send you a link for directions, right? We're not going to answer that question because that would be really outside the scope. And then if the customer says, well, where should I stop and get lunch on the way? That is definitely outside the scope of 90%. And so the AI actually will not answer to that and say, let me get you with one of our team members, and it will tag in a human in the loop, right? That's what it's called, as a human in the loop, because that's where the AI knows that something is going awry from the direction that it needs to be going to successfully complete the task at hand, which is scheduling an appointment, right? We don't need to be telling the person where to stop and get lunch. That's not what our AI is designed to do. Now, there are other people in the industry that are using very loose overlays over generative AI things that will allow that kind of stuff. We just won't do it. We're going to tag back in a human in the loop because we know that it opens up too much opportunity for something bad to happen with the customer experience. And so we don't want that. Does that make sense? Does that help?
Yeah. Sure. I guess out of what percentage of calls require a human?
So
you got to say,
this is kind of funny because when I'm talking at seminars and conferences, a lot of times people look at me weird when I say this, but we're almost the anti-AI company. Here's why. Chris was talking about the Apple spokesman and the Apple AI that he was communicating with. The average human is not ready for fully engaged AI conversations all the way through from start to finish. They actually want to talk to a live human. And so what we say all the time is, we want your humans talking to your customers, period, in the story. What our AI is going to do is it's going to bridge the gap. If you're not available, our AI is going to tag in, take the conversation as far as it can, and so that 90%, and then it's going to tag back in a human. So what might have been a 12-minute conversation can now be handled via a text message in 30 seconds, or a customer might need to get a call back and have something explained to them, which might take 2 or 3 minutes, but we're never starting from zero. And so that's really the key part of the process for us, is that we are making the people at the dealership so much more efficient. So we have a case study up on our website with Norm Reeves. Right, normally they've got the big store, Honda store out in Cerritos, and they've got 10 or 11 other dealerships right now that we're in 11 normally stores at this moment in time. Those 11 normally stores have a centralized BDC. The centralized BDC before NUMA was making about 3,000 outbound calls per month and scheduling 500 additional services off of those outbound phone calls. Okay, after they got NUMA launched at all the stores, the first 90 days after that, they actually made 9,000 outbound phone calls and scheduled 1,500 appointments. There are over 2,000 appointments a month right now that they're scheduling on outbound because NUMA drove efficiencies in communication so high, and it could handle 60% of the conversation, and a human only had to be involved in 40% of them. And so that changes the game for the BDC. Instead of now being inundated by those calls and being overwhelmed with just having to answer the phone, we're minimizing that and allowing them to maximize their outbound calls. So the CEO or COO there wanted to have 80% outbound, 20% inbound, right? They were at 60% inbound and 40% outbound. Now they're at 40% inbound and 60% outbound, and they have maximized this, just blown it out, and they love it because it's allowing them to produce and perform at a much higher rate, same amount of people.
The volume is just nuts.
Again, this is to the concept. We didn't completely replace those humans. We didn't come in and say, hey, Normies, get rid of 40% of your humans. We said, let's help them do their job through what we call large action models. Because our AI either handles the call or it predicts what the customer needs and lets the human in the loop know what the customer needs next.
And does it integrate with their existing systems, or is it basically like it lays on top of it? And so it's not replacing.
Not replacing anything. It just lays right on top of it.
One of the questions Chris was going to ask is about the current climate of the automotive industry, what your take is on challenges you're seeing. Obviously, there's one around communication, which you're addressing. Anything else that you see as a note on the current climate of the industry, and we've been talking about the CDK cyber attack too, which I think is dominating the lives of our customers. So, yeah, we'd love to get your take on that.
Yeah, so I think that two questions, right? So the number one challenge I think that I see today in the industry is turnover. Communication is a huge issue. Communication could be considered a symptom of a greater problem, which is turnover. If you look at the average life, and there you go. If you look at the average lifespan of an employee at a dealership, right, by position, it gets kind of scary. Salespeople, 9 months. Service advisors, 10, 11 months. Service managers, 18 months, right? And when you have that kind of turnover, if you look at BDC agents, hell, we see some dealerships where they're having to train new sales or BDC agents every 90 days. You never get to a point where you can be successful. Oh, I'm zooming in.
Whoa. All right.
So it is one of those things where you have to think in terms of what happens at the dealership. How do we get the best out of our people? And that's by retaining them. Right? And so how do you retain somebody? You train them, you give them a clearly defined job, and you support them. And with NUMA, what we're bringing into the system is a way that they can do their job very, very effectively. And we see dealerships tell us all the time that we've cut down turnover in the BDC because we've made the job not easier, but easier to manage. Because look, they got a hard job, right? Either making outbound phone calls or taking inbound phone calls. That's a hard job, no matter how you slice it. But we give them a tool that makes that job more manageable, that helps them through that job. And so that's a big thing. And I think that turnover is a huge issue that's plaguing our industry. And I think that retention of employees has to be a key driver for 2025. Like the successful dealerships, if you look, seriously look at the most successful dealerships out there, they have the highest retention. When you can get your average employee at 5 years or more, you have a profitable, successful, well-run dealership. When your average employee is less than a year, good Lord, you got a problem, right? you're going to have bad reputation, you're going to have bad communication, you're going to have bad gross profit, you're going to have bad turnover. You have all the negatives. And so we really believe that that's an issue, and it has to be addressed. Secondarily to that is the issue of technicians. There is an industry-wide shortage of technicians, and it's not going to get any better because we have all of these cars that are not aging out but are still requiring service that is a challenge for dealerships. And that's contributing a lot to the communication issues because there's more cars that are cycling through the service operation. And so we see this all over the place, right? We have dealers that tell us all the time, hey, man, don't schedule any more appointments. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's scary. That's scary. When you're talking 3-4 weeks out on a scheduled appointment, that's a problem. You got to do whatever it takes to get techs in there. And so, you know, we're huge advocates for working with the local junior college and the local technical trade schools, vocational schools, working with the OE to sponsor kids to come through and work through your lube oil filter rack as a rack technician that they can ultimately get moved up into something that's going to be a line tech, whether it could be an A, B, or C mechanic at some point in the future. There has to be, service technicians has to be a critical focus for the entire team at the dealership level. Like, that's the one position that you cannot overhire. Because if you've got the space and you can put a tech in, I promise you, we can fill the bay. We can fill the bay. There's no shortage of service work. There's a shortage of availability. So I think that's one. CDK cyber incident is, you know, it's kind of scary from a lot of standpoints. I think there's a saying, but there by the grace of God go I, right? Every dealership feels that, right? Because you're like, man, it could have been us. We could have been the guy that clicked on the link and got our entire dealership shut down with ransomware. And, you know, there is so much that you can do, and you can do it right, and one employee does one wrong thing, and you're done. It's frightening. When the CDK incident happened, we had a tenfold increase in attempted intrusions through phishing at our company, where we had people trying to use social engineering to fish our employees. And we have a shared Slack channel where everybody, anytime anybody saw one, we'd update everybody so everybody saw that this is what they just tried. And it was insane to see that.
Derek, 3 weeks ago we had an employee and they hacked her email, obviously, to get into her payroll account. We used Rippling. And they got inside, changed her bank account information, and she did get an email that she ignored because they were like, hey, did you change your bank information?
Right.
And she didn't pay attention to it. So that Friday, her money went into some other account.
Hmm.
So it's everywhere. And they'll never stop. We just have to get more diligent.
We're also getting so desensitized to those emails. It's like, I get so much crap every day.
But I get them every week, and it says, hey, it's from an employee saying that they need to change their bank information.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, hey, Chris, I need to change my bank information. But the prom email is always some crazy email. So they're always trying. They're trying from both sides, the employee side and the employer.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. And so, look, you know, you hire the right security contractors. You do the right security policies. You have the right insurance to back you up. That's the only thing that you can do as an operator. And then you have to continually do cybersecurity training. Like, it has to be part of the conversation. When I was running groups, I had a 10-week thing that I sent out a one-page thing for each department head to use in their department meetings that week over a 10-week period of time. And then we just rotated through. And then the next quarter, we do it again because there's new people. And we need to be talking about this. And, you know, if your CEO texts you and says, hey, I need something from you, and it's a number that you don't recognize, there's probably a good chance that that's not really the CEO texting you.
I need you to go to Walgreens and buy a bunch of Visa gift cards,
right? I can't log in.
Exactly.
Can you log in for me and send a link to this text message?
You hit a large organization, you're going to find somebody who's going to go take their ass to Rite Aid and, like, buy
those cards.
My mom was telling me that my stepfather gave his password out the other day, and I guess somebody called him and they said that they had these shirts, Tommy Bahama shirts for $10, and he thought it was a good deal, so he gives his password out. And she was like, why would you do this? They're not, the first sign of the scam is it's too good to be true. And $10 Tommy Bahama shirts is not even, you know, believable. And of course, he bet on it. It's not the first time.
So, look, at the dealership level, I really believe that you have to talk about cybersecurity every week. I just believe.
So one question that we ask in Discovery, Derek, that I wanted to address with you is we've always asked, how would you rate your team's current ability to execute customer experience? And we've always gotten between fours and fives until recently. And it seems like in recent years now, people are answering, and I'm having Mercedes points answer a three on customer experience.
Yeah.
And it's really alarming because, and I think it just goes back to the fact that over the past 4 years with COVID, the salespeople really didn't have to work that hard. I mean, they were order taking. And so it seems like there's a big need and a big desire for more training and really refining people's skills right now.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that self-reflection at a dealership level, when they answer that question, right? In the past, they would say a four or five because they felt like that's what everybody else was doing. Mm. Now they're like, yeah, the industry's pretty bad. They're like, yeah, we're probably a three. Because that's the reality that they know that they're not doing a good job. They know that they're not answering the phone. They know that they're not providing a level of service that exceeds the customer's expectations, right? And it's scary from that standpoint.
Yeah.
And it's not because they're bad people. Like, I cannot overemphasize this. It's very rare that we see a store that has bad customer experience. That's because they have bad people. It's because they're overwhelmed and they don't have the tools and the training of how to handle the situation. That's it. And anytime you throw somebody that's new into that, guess what you've done? You've exacerbated the problem.
Do you think customers have higher expectations now, or do you think it's just a deterioration of service?
No. I don't think it's a deterioration of service. I don't think that service is improved. And I think that there's more customers that are engaging in a different manner.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, we are not staffed or trained to handle it. I think that's the issue. I don't think that there is a true deterioration in customer service. I think that what's happened is we have turnover. I want you to think about this. You ready? The vast majority of phone calls at a dealership are answered by the lowest paid employee.
That's important.
That's literally the reality in the vast majority of dealerships. That the person that has the most interaction and the first connection with that customer is the lowest paid employee at the dealership with the highest turnover. So it's not that it's deteriorating. It's just that that system is challenged from the start when it's overwhelmed with calls, which is what's happening today. Phones ringing off the hook. We've never had call volumes in automotive that are as high as they are today. And I don't know if this is the pendulum swinging with internet leads versus, right? I've seen some stuff on this over the last 12 months that are saying that calls are starting to make a huge comeback. You know, Kyle Disher, Kyle and I have been talking about this a lot on the sales side, that people are picking up the phone and calling in instead of sending the form lead now. Because they don't want their information going in like that. They want to talk to somebody and see if they want to continue the conversation before they give them all their information. And so we're starting to see that, you know, on the sales side of that's picking up. And on the service side, how many customers truly know that they can click on that website and schedule the appointment painlessly with an online appointment scheduler, right? But the average dealership in North America is probably about 8% online appointment scheduling. When we start working with them, we drive that percentage up to 35-40% online appointment scheduling. And this is a bizarre statistic, but according to J.D. Powers over the last 10 years, if a customer schedules an appointment online, they are innately more happy than a customer that's scheduled any other way. It's bizarre.
What do you think is behind that?
The customer didn't want to interact. I think the customer wanted the easiest way to do it without having to be on hold and knowing they're going to get hung up on and knowing they're going to have to call back twice. And they click on that online appointment schedule. They self-serve. They're happy. They show up. They get service. They leave. Done. No muss, no fuss. Like, I really, truly believe that that's what is driving that. I think that the psychology of the communication, what's the stat? What stat have you guys seen about what percentage of customers would rather text with a dealership than talk to them. What are you guys seeing? What have you, if you, Cox had a study out, it was like 92% of customers said they'd rather text. And if you're trying to force a customer into a conversation that's on the phone that they don't want to do anyway, and it's a piss poor experience because they're on hold for 60 seconds, they're blind transferred to two different departments, and then the third person they talk to is like, yeah, I'm not the guy. I can't help you with that. Mm. Right? Think about that experience. Whereas a text, and they say, hey, I have a question, and the dealership responds to that text appropriately, what's the differential? And so we see this as a huge driver in communications, is that we have horrendously bad phone trees in this industry, right? Have you called into a dealership and tried to get to somebody?
Yeah, it's impossible.
What's it like? Think about that from a customer experience. I have to deal with all the time, man. Hey, when's the last time you mystery shopped your shop to try and schedule an appointment? When's the last time you tried to call him to get a part? You ready? Hey, I need to order a part. Okay. Ring, ring. Parts hold.
Yeah, we had Kyle on the pod a couple weeks ago, and he did a mystery shop for us live on the pod.
Yeah.
Right? So he called up a dealership, and he said it was one of the best ones he's had in terms of how they responded. And I'm listening to it thinking, oh, my God, this is a train wreck. I mean, the guy didn't ask for an appointment, didn't ask his name, didn't do any of these. Like, it was like, I'm thinking, Kyle, this is like one of the best ones you've had in a while. This is, it's crazy. So, yeah.
He offered to give the guy, before the guy came on, he goes, I'll send this guy a $100 gift card if he just sets an appointment. And he gave the guy the opportunity.
Not set an appointment, ask for an appointment. It wasn't even set, just ask.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, ask for an appointment. And the guy failed.
So what you're saying is, you guys understand what I'm talking about the phone. And this is something that I preach to our team, right? This is what I say all the time. We can have the best AI on the planet, which I really truly believe that we do, and you can put it in a phone tree in the wrong spot and we will fail. It's just that simple. If a customer has to get transferred three times before they're either talking to a human or talking to the AI, we have failed, right? So we have to go in. One of the big challenges that we have is that we have to go in and work with the dealership on how they have their IVR set up, how they have their call forwarding set up, how they have their hunt group set up, how they have their ring group set up, how they transfer internally a call to a call, right? Because when you look at this, that's not stuff that we've ever thought about. Not a car dealer, right?
Right.
Most of us set up the phone system when we bought the phone system and have not touched it since. And that could be last year or it could be 12 years ago. And so you have your number one tool of communication as a blocker for customers. There's something that you got to address right there.
I got a quick question. Are you doing the hiring too for the sales force for Pneuma?
Yes.
Are you looking for people that have automotive background or just more SaaS background? Like what are you looking for in these people?
Yes. So if somebody is a successful SaaS salesperson, I'll talk to them. What we have found is that in automotive, having a book of business, so to speak, relationships in automotive that you can leverage in that first 90 days tends to make the salesperson more successful out of the gate. The more successful they are out of the gate, the better they're going to be long term. You know, we have this very clearly defined plan about how we bring salespeople on, and our goal is ideally they will have some contacts that'll be one contact that then we can present to them for them, and that they can actually have some deals in their pipeline before they ever are even through product training. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. What do you look for in a candidate? Like, what makes a candidate for you stick out when you're dealing with God knows how many resumes?
I'll tell you what makes candidates stick out to me. I look for, and our team looks for, people that are going to fit our culture. So there's this theory in Silicon Valley. I said theory, and my iPhone thinks I said the other word. That rhymes with theory, that would be the iPhone start phrase. There's this theory that the company with the best culture wins because everybody makes a good product. That's the reality. Like in Silicon Valley, the people that are out there building products, nobody's building a crappy product. Nobody's dumb that's made it to the startup stage in Silicon Valley. These people are all certifiable geniuses. But if they don't have a good culture that can survive the ups and downs of what happens in a business and in an industry, they're going to fail before they get to the next phase. And so when investors look at companies, they're looking at culture. And so we got five key cultural values that we really look at, and we say, okay, do you fit these five core cultural values that we have? And one of those is this idea of driver, not a passenger. And too often what we see is that people that come to us that have potentially been at one of the really big companies, they tend to be more passengers because they're used to being fed stuff, right? Hey, here's a book of business to manage. Here's a lead to go close. What I'm saying is I want the guy that's going to pick up the phone and make 25 to 30 outbound phone calls to warm customers that is going to not need me to be on him or her about, did you make your calls today? Mm-hmm. But I know that when I look at the report on Friday, I'm going to see that they made, you know, 150 phone calls. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm looking for. I want somebody that's got the fire in the belly, that is excited about the product, and is willing to be the person that does the right stuff, because we all work remote when nobody's watching. And that's a, you know, it's hard to identify some of those things early, mm-hmm. but when we start the interview process and we're asking the questions, that's what we're actually looking for, right? We're wanting to know, are these people drivers, not passengers? That's a core thing for us. If they have a problem, what are they going to do?
Do you use any assessments or anything like that to try to figure out?
We're not doing personality assessments yet, but we have core questions that are associated with each of our values that we do. And so when you go through your tiered interview with the company, I'm going to ask a question around one core value. Somebody else is going to ask questions around another core value. Somebody else is going to ask questions around another core value. We're still looking at core competencies as far as being a salesperson or a CS manager or an implementation manager. But then we look at, so I ask people, this is one of the questions that I ask them. I say, hey, tell me about a time that you failed at your last job, and then how did you recover from it? Maybe it's not even your job. Tell me something in your personal life if you want. I'd love to hear an example about a time that something went wrong and then what you did after that. And that tells you a ton, right? Because everybody's going to say, well, I pick up the phone and make phone calls. Well, tell me what happened when you had something bad happen and what was it? Invariably, you get a pretty good look at a person when they tell you. Because failure is defining, right? How you come out of failure is really what's important. Because as a salesperson, how many times you hear no? Yeah, but you're going to hear no a whole hell of a lot more times than you can hear yeah. And how do you deal with that? And then I want to know, what happens when you get coaching? Because we're not perfect. I get coached. My CEO had a coaching session with me a couple of weeks ago, right? The very first thing that I wanted to do was justify my behavior because I'm a human. And then when I opened myself up and listened to what he was saying, and I acknowledged the area of opportunity for me, and then I looked at how could I take the next steps to get better, that's what we have to do. Right? And I love people that were high school or college athletes. I love people that have done competitive events with a coach, right? What did they, you know, we used to talk about this all the time, right, Chris? Even Tiger Woods had a coach, right? Even Kobe Bryant had a coach.
Yep.
You can be the best person of all time, and you can do everything right, but you still need a coach that's looking at things through a different lens that's going to help you see areas of opportunity that you might not have seen. Right? And that can drive the direction that you need to go to succeed. And so I ask, hey, how do you respond to coaching? Here's what happened. We had a situation. We had to sit down and have a conversation about it. I'm going to be very clear. I'm going to tell you what happened, where I think that we went awry, and then we'll tell you what I think some of the best practices for us to do better are. How are you going to respond to that? And people will flat out say, I shut down.
Really?
I've heard the easiest things in conversations. They're like, I just don't do good with feedback like that.
At least they're honest.
I'll give you one that I always ask, and I want to ask you this. So I always ask, what do you want to be known for?
Oh, I love that. I think it's pretty cool. And I think that when you look at who you are as an individual, I think that we are all multifaceted, right? And I want to be known as an incredible father, right, to two amazing children, a person that's committed to his community and helping others succeed, and the sales leader that brought a startup to a $1 billion company. That's what I'm shooting for every day. Like, this is not, like, it's not negotiable. Like, those are the things that I, like, is a core value to me, right? And so how do we keep working towards that? I love that question, Chris. That's amazing.
Yeah. I learned that from Jeff Henderson. He wrote a book, What Do You Want to Be Known For? And the follow-up question to that is, what are you known for?
I think that I'm pretty much known for those things. I feel like I have not done enough for my community, right? This is one of the things that I talk about a lot, is that, you know, you only have so much time in a day. There are levers. I believe that there are levers in life that you can pull, but there's only one or two levers that you can ever pull at the same time. And right now I am truly focused on my kids, getting them through college, which they're both about to graduate, and the company and the growth, right? I am looking forward to that next phase when I have a little bit more time and I can do some more charitable stuff and I can be more involved in the community, right? I'd love to create a foundation with my daughter where we're working with underprivileged kids through basketball or judo and Brazilian jiu-jitsu and art and bringing in underprivileged kids to an area that's safe for them, that they can work and they can do those things. That's something that's a lifelong goal for me. I haven't done it yet. And, like, it bothers me that I haven't done it yet, because I know that there's times that I've had time to do it and I haven't. And so that's something that I look at in the future state for Derek. And I say, yeah, that's gotta, we gotta start doing something there. And I love being asked to give back my time to different social organizations. I love when somebody asks me that, because I don't think of that. You know what I mean? Because I get so linear focused on, what are we doing with the company? What are we doing with the kids? What are we doing, you know, right now? Mm. And I don't think of that. So I think that's a growth thing for me. So there you go.
That's cool.
Thank you so much, Derek. Great interview. Love, always enjoy our talk.
Yeah, thank you. Where can people find you or reach out to you if they want to connect more?
So I am Derek Simons on pretty much any social media platform, or it's real easy to email me, and it's just Derek@Numa.com, Derek@Numa.com, Derek@Numa.com. But they can email me, they can ping me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, doesn't matter. I'm there. I'm out there.
Awesome.
This has been awesome. Yeah, great interview. Really interesting talking to you, too.
Love your partner in the background, too. He's been entertaining us.
This is so fun.
Diego.
Yeah. What are you doing? Are you sleeping right now? I got up this morning, Chris, and I worked out, and then I did a hike on the Peloton treadmill, right, because I wanted to get some, you know, really high angle elevation in. And he's like, all right, this is ridiculous. If we're running, if you're doing this, we should be outside. Like, I need to run too. Like, what are you doing on this treadmill? I'm like, well, we don't have any hills here in Florida, so I got to get on the treadmill.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much.
You guys.
Take care.
You're awesome, buddy. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Anything I can do for you guys, you know I'm there.